building of mosques, madrasas, in Africa and all kinds of places in the Middle East, has spread a kind of modern Islam, which the great Islamic scholars that we still luckily have around today say is nothing to do with Islam as it's supposed to be.
The rise of extremism of ideologies similar to that of ISIS has been a growing feature for the last 40 years. And I think the main reason for this is the growing influence of Wahhabism. And this, I think, is a very important context in which ISIS and the other jihadi movements have grown up and flourished.
Since the onset of the civil war in Syria in 2011, the West and its regional allies had backed the armed opposition with weapons, training, and funds, despite the fact it contained groups linked to Al-Qaeda. Over the next 3 years, these groups became stronger, creating today's ISIL.
The terminologies which are being used by the West, the use or indeed the misuse of the Quranic words in trying to define barbaric acts. For example, jihad is being used, mujahideen has been used for defining those people who are takfiris, who are chopping people's head off, and then associating that with the concept of mujahid. They are trying deliberately to dirty this holy sort of concept.
The Western powers and their regional allies, like Saudi Arabia, always portrayed the Syrian opposition as being much more moderate than it was. They were always talking about backing the moderates against Assad. But it was completely obvious over the last year that the opposition was increasingly dominated by jihadi groups, notably ISIS, but others like Jabhat al-Nusra as well.
Perhaps the most revealing comments on the funding and support ISIL had received at its outset came from U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. Speaking at Harvard University in October 2014, Biden exposed U.S. allies as the main supporters of al-Qaeda and ISIL in Syria.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I've just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad, except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world.
Biden was forced to apologize to Saudi Arabia and Turkey for the gaffe, but that cannot change the revelations he made. However, Biden did not reveal why Washington and London did nothing despite knowing that their allies were supporting terrorist groups in Syria. Britain even started officially to fund the so-called armed opposition in Syria in 2012, but never revealed the identity of the receivers.
In the absence of diplomatic progress, the United Kingdom will do much more. We will expand our support to the Syrian people and the Syrian political opposition with an extra £5 million in non-lethal practical assistance.
William Hague, the then Foreign Secretary of Britain, once had the misfortune to be in a lift with me, going up five floors. So he was trapped. And I said this to him, all these people that you are encouraging in their hundreds, now it's thousands, to go there and fight with these extremists, when they come back home, they're going to be trained with a twisted mindset in all the dark arts of terrorism. The bombs that they made, the car bombs, the hideous decapitations and tortures and so on that they have practiced there, when they come back here, they'll practice on us. At that point, the lift door opened and Mr. Haig escaped, so I never did get a reply. Although I did ask, as I said, David Cameron on the floor of the House, if he would explain for the House the main differences, just the main ones, between the Al-Qaeda we're supporting in Syria and the Al-Qaeda we're opposing everywhere else. He had no reply.
The traces of collusion with Takfiri radicalism can also be found in the story of Britain's attempts to retain control over the Suez Canal in the 1950s. The Arab nationalist leader Britain hated the most was the President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt. He came to power in 1953 and first succeeded in removing the vast network of British bases, which were there, and then in 1956, in nationalizing the Suez Canal, refusing compensation to his British and French owners. In 1956, Britain and France, in alliance with Israel, invaded Egypt in an attempt to seize the canal back.
France and Britain issue a 12-hour ultimatum that all fighting must cease. Within hours of its expiration, Britain's warplanes are winging their way to Egypt, and its bombers attack five key cities, including Cairo.
It failed in part because of Egyptian resistance, and in part because the U.S. didn't support the old empires asserting themselves like that.
The United States was not consulted in any way about any phase of these actions, nor were we informed of them in advance. In the circumstances I have described, there will be no United States involvement in these present hostilities.
Britain cast around for allies against Nasser, and its eyes fell on the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that when Britain had ruled Egypt, it had suppressed that organization.
At that point, the Islamist forces, the Muslim Brotherhood and others, weren't the major threat, and therefore they could be suborned, or the attempt could be made to suborn them, against Nasser, who was suppressing them.
The rise of Arab nationalism also cemented British and U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and other autocratic regimes in the Persian Gulf.
Dana Reskit argued in 2012, quoting from a document which reveals Britain's necessity to get Saudi backing at any price. The document's entitled, "The Report by the Joint Intelligence Committee, Nationalist and Radical Movements in the Arabian Peninsula," and it's dated 10th of February 1958. It reads, "Arab nationalism, including the urge towards greater Arab unity and the removal of any foreign control, is already the most powerful emotional force in the area, and it is beginning to penetrate even the most remote corners of the peninsula." The conclusion was, "The maintenance of our interests in the Persian Gulf states is dependent on continued stability in the area. At present, only the rulers can provide this. No other alternative regime is in sight."
The Cold War extended the scope of collusion with Takfiri radicalism to countries beyond the Middle East. By the late 1950s, both London and Washington were viewing Indonesia with concern. They saw its nationalist leader Sukarno as an enemy because he allied with the Communist Party and was friends with China.
In the project to overthrow Sukarno, again, British and American imperialism identified the most extreme so-called Islamic elements to act against the nationalism of Sukarno.
In 1957, he nationalized companies, including the Indonesian offshoot of the Anglo-Dutch oil giant Shell.
Britain and the United States determined to use right-wing army generals and the Darul Islam group to foster rebellion against Sukarno. In a document I have here written in 1957, Britain's Commissioner General for Southeast Asia, Sir Robert Scott, told the Foreign Office, "I think the time has come to plan secretly with the Australians and Americans how best to give these elements the aid they need. He added, referring to Sukarno, "I believe it should be one of our aims to bring about his downfall."
The decisive moment in the history of Britain and the West's involvement with Takfiri radicalism came in 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan to bolster a pro-Moscow regime threatened by Islamic Bedouins. F. William Engdahl, in his collection A Century of War, Anglo-American War Politics and the New World Order, quotes from Dr. Bernard Woods, well known for his hostile attitude towards Islam. He stated, "At the meeting of the elite Bilderberg Group in May 1979, British-American Islamic expert Dr. Bernard Woods said
that endorsing the Muslim Brotherhood would allow the Western elite to promote balkanization of the entire Muslim Near East along tribal and religious lines. This balkanization process would result in the rise of various autonomous groups and the spreading of chaos in the Near East. In what Lewis termed an arc of crisis, the chaos would eventually spill over into the Muslim regions of the Soviet Union. This would help Western elites counter Soviet moves."
I went to Kabul in 1981, the first time when the Soviets were still there. In fact, they'd only just come 2 years earlier. And the embassy, British embassy, was open, and so was the American embassy. And they used to feed propaganda about what the Mujahideen were doing. And it was relayed to briefings, which I also attended in Islamabad and in New Delhi, where you weren't